This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Brom, the author Brom, B-R-O-M, who's the author of The Child Thief, a novel. Hi, Brom. How are you?
Hey, David. How are you doing?
I'm great. It is really great to talk to you about this book. You know, it just as an introduction to people who are listening who may not know about it, The Child Thief, it refers to Peter Pan, and it's much more complicated than a simple description of like that, but it gives you an idea. I guess I wanted to talk to you first, before we actually start talking about The Child Thief, just about the history of your work and what you've done in the past. I know you started as an artist and an illustrator of books, but maybe you could, you know, just kind of give a little short summary of your background and how you got to this point of writing this book.
Certainly. Well, first, I just want to thank you for taking the time to do the interview. I certainly appreciate that. Pleasure to be here. As far as where I got my start, most people know me first as an artist because the first 20 years of my career was primarily focused on that. But I've always considered myself a storyteller. Ever since I was a small child, I wrote stories and illustrated them. At that time it was with magic markers and staplers, and now, thanks to technology, I can sit in my room and I can write a story and illustrate it, put it all together on the computer. So it's very, very similar from a creative point of view, just minus the stapler. I guess my first start is with the painting. I was doing a lot of work for gaming companies like TSR, because in the early 80s, that was one of the primary avenues for creative illustration. The commercial market was a bit more focused on airbrushy type of look, and I liked the traditional oils, and I had a history of enjoying illustrated novels like the N.C. Wyeth illustrations and that sort of thing. So that was sort of where I was pushing my career.
So you worked in, when you started as an artist, you didn't actually intend for your, you didn't start out with the goal of having your art be used for video games or illustrated books. How did you get into that part of the business?
So I think my primary source of inspiration has always been literature, reading whether the Edgar Rice Burroughs books, John Carter Mars, or the early Conan books, and then J.R. Tolkien. And I would read these books, and as a child and mid-teens, I would do illustrations from them. So my heart is in illustration. And again, when I was left art school, it was probably the mid-80s, all I could get work doing was commercial art, which was photorealistic Coke cups and product illustration. And this creatively was as far from what I was wanting to do as it could be. I mean, I was very happy to be making a living at art, but it wasn't where my heart wanted to be. So I put together a portfolio of the kind of work I liked, which tended more towards fantasy and science fiction and horror. And I would go to comic conventions and pass the work around. And at that point, the easiest way to get in the door was with these small gaming publishers or with small comic publishers as well. So I did quite a few covers that paid dirt, but I was so happy to be doing those because they were creative. And then what happened is I did an interview for a company called TSR up in Wisconsin. I was living in Atlanta at the time. And this was my first portfolio of work, and I went up and presented it to them, and they were not at all impressed. They were basically said, "We've got a spot open to hire somebody, but on the list, you're on the very bottom." So I kind of went back to Atlanta dejected, but I was very determined to break into the book cover market. And my wife and myself went up to New Jersey, and we rented an apartment, and we went back and we packed up. We're going to move to New Jersey, and I'm going to break into the book department one way or the other. We had packed everything but the phone. I was waiting for a phone call from my parents to let them know we're leaving. And the phone rings, and it's TSR, the gaming company. And apparently none of the other people on their list wanted to move to a small town in Wisconsin, so I got the job there. And TSR, since that's all they did was role-playing games, I suddenly found myself on staff in a small town in Wisconsin, painting, you know, the type of artwork I always wanted to do.
That's pretty cool, actually. Yeah, so it's kind of one of those lucky moments, lucky accidents, that you were willing to move. You were young enough and unattached enough to be willing and able to move.
It was, and it was pretty funny, too, because when he called me, you know, we had it all packed up to go to New Jersey, and he said, would you like the job? And I said, love the job. And he was like, well, how long will it take you to get out of your lease and pack and move up here? I said, about 2 days.
So what town are they in?
It was Lake Geneva, Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, Lake Geneva is not exactly the boondocks. It's, you know, it's not that far from Chicago. It's a pretty, you know, established town. It's not a bad place to be.
It's not a bad place. It's about an hour out of Milwaukee, but somehow being out in that cold tundra through those winters felt very isolating. So, and then we did the disservice of buying a house that was even another half hour sort of in the woods on a lake called Lake Wendawega. You know, it's one of those places when you saw the house, it was like, oh, this beautiful place, I'd love to vacation here. But after you're actually stuck on a frozen lake through a whole cold winter, you're like, please get me somewhere where there's some culture.
Oh, that's funny. Well, so here you were at this time doing cover illustrations, and obviously you got pretty successful at it over the years. I mean, I think, you know, your work has, you know, it's been pretty widely used, I think, and celebrated by a lot of people.
I've been at it for about 20, 25 years now, I hate to say. So, I've pretty much dabbled in just about every genre and every, you know, whether it's movies, whether it's books, whether it's games, computer games, album covers, anything that needs, you know, sort of a dark, fantastical edge, I'm there.
And what, I mean, I'm sure you get this question a million times, so it's probably old news to you, but what caused you to use a single name for yourself in art and now as a writer?
It's funny, that's come up, it's never came up as an artist, but since I started writing, it's come up in a lot of, you know, fan mails and things I've read on the internet, and I never thought much about it. My full name is Gerald Brom, but I was, grew up an army brat, and kids army brats tend to call each other by their last name, but Brom just stuck as a nickname from early on, since like about junior high school on, and my friends called me Brom. And from an artistic point of view, that's how I signed my name on the paintings, by my last name. So that just sort of perpetuated it. You know, people referred to me as Brom. So when I moved into my writing career, I had already established, you know, the identity as just Brom, B-R-O-M, and it just seemed natural to continue that on into the novels. But like I said, I think because people have picked up the book not knowing of my illustration past, it's caused a little bit of raised eyebrows. Why does he just have one name?
It makes you stand. I mean, you certainly stand out in the crowd, and it's a conversation point. So, you know, in terms of people paying attention, you know, you're competing in the world as an artist and a writer with so many different other people. You know, probably it's good to have something that identifies you in this way. You know, that it's just one more thing that calls attention to your work. It's not a bad thing.
Right, I feel that way. I just didn't want people to feel it was some sort of self-conscious, pretentious effort there, you know, that it was truly a name that I've gone by most of my life. So
let's talk a little bit about the child thief. I mean, partly this seems like, I mean, it's a pretty major effort. It's a big book. It's, you know, almost 500 pages. You've got illustrations. And I wouldn't call it an illustrated book. I think that it's almost like an old-fashioned late 19th century novel where the illustrations are there from time to time, illustrating certain scenes. You know, if you think about England in the late 19th century, early 20th century, it's fairly common to see that with, particularly with children's books or, you know, kind of supernatural stories, fairy tales. There's, you know, some illustrations so you can see that way the character is imagined by an artist, but not necessarily, you know, it's not like a graphic novel where the book and the art and the words interact together on every page. So I think of this as a novel with illustrations, let's call it that.
Right. And it's, you know, that you mentioned the old fairy tale books and even like I was mentioning earlier, the novels that N.C. Wyeth illustrated. I always liked that kind of book. It was a novel first, and then it had, you know, the occasional illustrations, and that's exactly what I modeled it
right
after.
Actually, yeah, come to think of it, The Wizard of Oz was that way in the original version.
Before The Chop Thief, I had actually did two previous novels, the Plucker and another one called The Devil's Rose, and those were more towards, I wouldn't say graphic novels, but they were very heavily illustrated. There's probably a full color painting on every page, and as I was introducing, you know, learning the craft of writing, I relied much heavier on my illustration skills in those books, and you know, people seem to enjoy the writing. So with this book, I wanted to see if you know, my writing abilities could carry the weight of the story. So this was, you know, definitely an effort to try to tell a story through words first and then pictures with more accents.
Right. So in a lot of ways, this is really, and this counts as your first novel.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, I think, I mean, first of all, I think it's a great book. It was completely captivating.
Oh, thank you.
You know, I think it's hard to take characters and stories that are so well known for so many people and rework them in a new way and still have it work. I think that's that requires some effort, and it's a feat, I think, to accomplish it, and obviously I think you have.
Well, thank you.
You know, what I think is interesting is that you've mashed together Peter Pan in an image that's, you know, that is kind of recognizable, but makes him much darker and more complex than the more recent versions, and takes him back to the earlier version. But you've also then essentially concatenated him into Avalon, Arthurian pre-England magical time, mm-hmm. and then combined that with North America, because, it, you know, as you have it in the story, that Avalon kind of broke away from the old world and ended up attached to the new world. And I love the, you know, the kind of transformation of these early Europeans landing on the shores of America and accidentally ending up in Avalon, where the magic transforms them. Because they are not able to exist in that world in their human form.
Right.
It's a really, I think those, you know, all of that stuff really works well. And of course you have Peter Pan then with a gateway into a contemporary, a modern America, particularly, specifically New York, where he goes in search of more children, to enlist, essentially, into his crew. And then, you know, I don't want to give away the whole story, because it's really, you never want to take away the adventure and the mystery that, you know, a new reader might have. So,
sure.
You know, I've got to be careful not to give away too much, but
absolutely.
I got to say that, you know, there's a tremendous richness, I think, in this story. And I'm just curious, I kind of want to understand what imaginative leaps got you here.
Well, I'm thrilled to hear that you enjoyed the story, and it seemed to all work for you, because it's, when you're putting a story together like this, it's like making a puzzle, and it's you know, trying to figure out how all the pieces go together. But when I started, I knew I didn't want to just do a retelling of a classic fairy tale. I was really trying to use the Peter Pan mythos as sort of a jumping off point. The more I dug into Peter Pan and read into the story, and beyond that, read into, you know, did research and to find out just, you know, what inspired James Barry to write his version of Peter Pan, because so many people are very confused with the Disney Peter Pan than with the James Barry Peter Pan, which was a much darker story with a lot of underlining adult themes. So the more I dug into it, there was just so much richness there. And then once I tied in, realized, you know, so much of his inspiration came from not so much Arthurian legends, but, you know, the actual mythological legends before that, and doing those research and making the connections. And it was fascinating how many things lined up. And then it was a matter of, you know, building my own mythology by combining all these things. But one of the, if I can step back just a little bit to the inspiration of the Peter Pan, when I started reading through, I went and read one of the original versions that, you know, haven't been quite so watered down and had so much taken out of them. And there was one paragraph in particular that sort of, to me, was the turning point of determining who this, you know, Peter Pan would be if he was, you know, told in a more realistic, gritty reality type of setting. So let me read this one paragraph to you. And this is out of the original Peter Pan by James Barry. It goes, "The boys on the island vary, of course, in numbers according as they get killed and so on. And when they seem to be growing up, which is against the rules, Peter thins them out. But at this time, there were six of them, counting the twins as two." So the line, "Peter thins them out," you know, that struck a chord to me. It's like, well, what does that mean? You know,
right. Yeah, I know. There's a really, that's kind of like a throwaway, right?
Yeah. I mean, it can mean so many different things. But I sort of took that and sort of ran with it a little bit that, you know, that he's taking these kids to this island, again, in the original Peter Pan. And, you know, Barry's lyrical prose makes it all seem like a big, you know, chuckle and we're having a good time here. But when you read deeper, it's, you know, there's a high body count. There are lines in there, and again, I'm reading from a couple things I have here where at one point the boys proudly debate the number of pirates they've just slaughtered. Was it 15 or 17? Well, you can call them pirates, but they're, you know, they're human beings. They're adults, and there's kids that are just slaughtering them. You know, one kid killing 15 pirates, if you put that into, you know, a realistic setting, that would be, you know, horrific. And another quote that Peter says in the book is, he goes, "I forget them after I kill them," he replied carelessly. So, you know, it's this really, you know, let's make a game out of killing type of thing. So these were all jumping off points. And, you know, again, that combined with some of the mythological fairy background that James got to, it was, to me, it just sort of all started to line up, and it was like I couldn't type fast enough. There were so many cool ideas to go with.
Well, and so how long did it take you to, I mean, did you map this out, you know, as you started going, or did it just sort of, I mean, in other words, I guess there's two different ways of doing this, at least, kind of structurally. One is imagine the universe that you're building and then map it out in a kind of structural outline way. The other way would be to start writing and see what happens and where new ideas almost spring up because you're living in that imaginative world.
It was kind of both. It kind of happened both ways. The original story I wrote focused much more on the character Nick. And when I hooked up with EOS, with my editor, Diana Gill, who's just an amazing editor, you know, it was her idea that this should be more about Peter Pan. And so I had one story written, and then it was really going back and putting Peter Pan into that story, which was a very creatively challenging to try to take a story and then infuse a whole other story into it. But in a way, by being forced to do that, it forced me to come up with, I think, took me down avenues I wouldn't have done if I was just sitting down and outlining the story. And so a lot of the background fairy elements and mythological elements came about trying to explain, you know, where and how Peter Pan came from. And
right. No, that makes actually a lot of sense. And, you know, it's sort of, I hear you describe it, and having read the book, I understand exactly the merger of the two stories really works. And I should say, for people who are listening, Nick is a character you introduce at the very beginning. He's the kid who Peter gets from a very bad situation at home. He's a sort of classic Peter target, which is an unhappy kid who needs to be rescued and is willing to leave on this journey that requires a lot of trust in this person he's just met.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a really disaffected kind of tween or early teenager is probably his target. And then there's the passage, you know, going from real world New York to the world of Avalon, where it's pretty fraught and not everybody survives as you have it either. So it's, you know, I think Nick is he remains a very key character throughout the book, right up until the end.
Well, I also felt it was important to have a modern person's perspective on all the things that were going on. And he's kind of our eyes and perspective on Peter's actions and the strangeness of the world he finds himself in.
Right, and he's actually, you know, not accepting it blindly. You know, the big difference here between, let's say, a James Barry or almost, you know, many, many fairy tale writers and even mythology writers, there's a line between this world and that world, and when you enter that other world, you have to give up your worldly expectations and judgments and live in that world completely, whereas in your concept, you actually, the characters who come into that world bring with them all of their knowledge, beliefs, and outlook, including some judgmentalness about what's going on in this other world. And then, of course, I thought it was really, really powerful to have the, you know, these I guess I'm not giving away too much, but the bad guys essentially are who you call flesh eaters. They're these twisted and transformed beings who we learn later are early British settlers in Virginia. I assume it's Virginia.
They were, you know, some of the original Puritans coming over, you know, like to settle up in the Northeast, exactly.
Yeah, and so they, you know, I think you make them much more complex and sympathetic. As time goes on, we learn more about them, how they got this way. There's a whole rich subtextual world of them, which allows you to talk about, you know, Puritan religion and the relationship between the different members of that community. And, you know, I thought that was actually pretty interesting and powerful, too, because you could read them as a symbolic of many values in our current world. You know, there's a little bit of social criticism running through there, I think. I don't know whether you intended that, but it certainly comes across that way.
Yeah, you know, I think what happens is sometimes it's when you're trying to make something believable or make sense. It's, I often start out trying to have a bad character, an evil character that's up to no good, but in trying to show their motivation, I can't help but become sympathetic with their point of view. So more often than not, you know, characters that are meant to be, you know, just more antagonistic end up becoming, like I said, sympathetic. And I think in a way that does make the whole story more interesting when you can see both points of view or all points of view.
Yeah, and I think that's also fitting and suited to the modern outlook that, you know, we are, you know, obviously there are people who tend to either see the world or paint the world in black and white, but gray and complexity and nuance are much more modern in outlook. It's more complex. It's what we like to think of as, you know, kind of more challenging and interesting, I think, in art.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a place probably for, you know, the black and, you know, kind of black and white view of the world, but I think there's equally and maybe more appealing to me, or to grown-ups, something that's complex.
Right.
And reflects, you know, the fact that even bad has, you know, or evil has complexity to it. And, you know, you try to figure out what people are who are, in fact, these negative energy beings. You know, how did they get that way? Why are they the way they are? And how do they experience the world? I think that's pretty, you know, that's powerful.
And there's also so much misinformation going on in the world. I mean, whether you see current political conflicts or wars from way back, there's just complete either lack of communication or miscommunication going on. And if people could just truly know what the other side was thinking or their goals, I think often a lot of conflicts could be resolved before they started.
Oh, I think that's clearly true. But also sometimes people take those positions or, you know, kind of willfully choose not to see the other side. And of course, you know, the classic is if you can make your enemy not human, then it allows you to do almost anything you wish to them.
Right.
You know, that's what settlers in America, you know, these same people came, you know, they came to America and killed Indians because they did not believe that they were human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And it's whenever you treat the other, somebody different from you, I think, as less than human, not yourself, then it allows you this kind of behavior that you would never accept otherwise.
Dehumanize and demonize, it makes it a lot easier to kill them, sure.
Oh, absolutely. So, so I'm just curious, do you have any plans to continue with these characters? You leave them in a place at the end of the book, and again, without giving anything away, you leave them in a place where that door is pretty wide open to keep on going.
Right. I just loved playing in this world, and I do hope I get back to it at some point. I purposely left things room for it to continue, so to speak. I mean, I feel like things did come to some conclusions there, but there's room to keep going. Currently, I have so many ideas that I want to get out there that it's almost tough to find the time to come back to one I've already got going, but to date, I've gotten such wonderful support in response to this book. Maybe a book or two down the line, I can hopefully come back and continue Peter's adventure.
Yeah, maybe, or maybe, something else will happen, with him, or with that world, too.
Yeah, or tie him into maybe one of the other book projects I have going. I always love it when authors do that sort of thing. It makes their universes so much larger.
Right, well, it's sort of like what Marvel used to do with, characters from one series would enter another comic.
Yeah.
And have a role to play. Of course, I think they took that maybe too far at some point.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But, what else are you working on? What's the thing you're working on now?
I have a bucket full of ideas. I have a folder, and every idea that comes in my head, I'll start writing them down. And there's a few that I'm just really, they're really dear to my heart. But I just signed up to do two more books for EOS, and I'm currently working away on one. And unfortunately, I can't give anything away at this point. The idea itself is something that I feel is unique enough that I kind of want to keep it under wraps. But I will say it continues, in my tradition of sort of dark and absurd in its oddness. But I'm currently plugging away on it. It's going to be another novel similar in size and scope to The Child Thief. So it's going to be, mostly written but accompanied with illustrations.
Oh, that's cool. I can understand why you wouldn't want to talk about it in any kind of detail way. I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
Oh, not at all.
But I think, you've sort of gained, at least in me, you've gained a new fan. I'm a pretty, I've recommended this book to people who I know are interested in kind of imaginative fiction. And, I think this book is to me, very special. I think you've done, just a spectacular job. And, again, when people say someone is reinventing or retelling, a classic story, your antennae start to wiggle like, oh, what have they done? What are they, what are they trying to do here? But this is, as a reinvention, I think, pretty imaginative and pretty crazy, and it really held together. And, you're a good writer, so made it work.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it. I think, thank goodness, I sort of went into it so naively. I mean, if I had really thought about that, I might have been more apprehensive. But it was just, to me, it was just such exciting material. It just seemed to kind of almost write itself.
It must be a great feeling. I think that, I've heard writers say that, when you enter this vein, it's sort of like you've stumbled across a story that is in the air and it's coming through you in this powerful way. It kind of inhabits the writer, and the story tells itself in some way. And I don't want to, there's all kinds of ways of looking at that. You've tapped into a part of your own brain, or you've tapped into the well of Jungian stories that are out there.
Right.
You had the good sense to write it down, because some people hear those stories, they don't write them down, they do something else with them.
You certainly have to be willing to spend a lot of time by yourself in a room
right.
to get all of that down. But,
so do you go back and forth between writing and painting, or do you, when you're writing, do you just let the painting go?
The two support each other wonderfully. I will It's gone both ways. Sometimes there's a painting or an image I've done, and like I said, I always considered myself a storyteller. So every painting I've ever done, while I'm painting it, I'm thinking who this character is, what he's doing, you know, what's about to happen, what has happened. So sometimes there will be an image or a painting I create that will, you know, inspire a story, which will lead into a story. My second, my graphic novel of The Devil's Rose was that way. There was a undead gunslinger character I had painted, and I just fell in love with that character, and I really wanted, A, to paint him more, and, you know, B, to tell his story, make him come to life, because with the words, you know, you get to make them move around and think and talk, so that's very exciting. But to answer your question, when I'm actually in the process, you know, let's say I start out with more with a story idea, I will start outlining in it and conceptualize, you know, kind of where it starts and where it ends. And then usually the next step is because I'm visualizing these characters, I'll start sketching them. And in that process, I discover more about them. You know, what are they wearing? What kind of shoes do they have on? And that discovery can actually lead to expanding the writing. And it goes back and forth. And so the two, you know, feed off each other and support each other. And then, you know, by the time the writing, I usually wait till the writing's completely done before I do, you know, a lot of paintings, because things are so subject to change in the writing. But then I do the final paintings, and when the final paintings are done, I have found that, again, there have been discoveries in those paintings where I've gone back into the manuscript and tweaked it, you know, added little details that I discovered in the painting.
Yeah, that is really cool. I think that tells you a lot about how your imagination works, you know, and how the two different parts of... Because I see, you know, writing and art are not, you know, they're not inherently of a part. I mean, I know there are plenty of writers, plenty of artists who do some writing, but I think it's rare to find someone who can do both. You know, they seem, the verbal and the imagistic seem to be skill sets that rarely do people contain in their brains together, which you obviously have.
Well, thank you. Very glad to hear it. It's funny because writing's all about communication, and you can hear something so clearly in your head and visualize it so clearly while you're writing, but at the end of the day, it's hard to tell if you're getting across those emotions and thoughts, you know, as writers, you're always insecure about that, so it's always wonderful to hear that, you know, you have indeed communicated on some level to somebody. So
well, I can attest, you definitely have with me. I've said it a lot, but I only interview writers on this program whose books I like, obviously, I like this, I more than like this book, I really loved it, so it's really been great to have a chance to talk to you about it, and thanks for taking the time today.
Yeah, well, thank you, very much appreciated, and I've enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks. This is David Wilk for Writer's Cast. I've been talking to Brahm, the author and illustrator, of course, of The Child Thief, a novel which clearly I am recommending. So thanks again.